Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Truth and Movies, my old friend. This week, it's a special Don't Go to the Cinema, You Might See These Movies edition. First up, Age of Stupid gets its signature film with Transformers, the toughest Baywatch since, well, Baywatch. Then, the extraordinary Book of Henry. It's horrid, more misjudged than a beauty pageant, but is it bad enough to get the director fired from the next Star Wars gig? We'll be talking about the worst movies ever made, and speaking of cobblers, saluting Daniel Day-Lewis plus Film Club, in which we are all excited by a 50-year-old, ironic really, given that it's The Graduate. That's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yeah, thanks very much for joining us, everybody. We've got a fresh cast of faces for you today, with Adam Woodward returning. Hi, Adam.
Hello.
Good to see you back. And joined by Michael Leader.
Hello.
Out of Film 4 and the extended Little White Lies family.
Extended family member, that's me.
Right, OK. What have you been working on of late, Michael?
So, for Little White Lies, I've been writing reviews and separately doing Cannes reviews for Sight and Sound. My day job, I work for Film 4 as their online editor for social media and the website.
Right.
But I also program on the side as Misc Films.
Mm. OK, well, for us this week, you've seen two pretty remarkable films. We'll come on to the first of those in a second or two. Just a quick reminder that you can get in touch with us on Twitter at LW Lies via Facebook at the Little White Lies magazine page. And the email address, Adam, is?
Truth and Movies, all one word, at tcolondon.com.
Boom. Had one or two little messages. A lot of people saying they can't travel on the M25 anymore without thinking about my breakdown last week. Also, Jamie O'Halloran says, rather than discussing bad cinema experiences, why don't we talk about amazing ones? We'll do that in future. If you had an amazing cinema experience, one that hopefully we can air in public, do let us know. It's nice to accentuate the positive, isn't it? Particularly in this week of all weeks, a week which saw us sit through Transformers: The Last Night.
Keep a secret for so long, knowing it to be true, and yet deep down inside, you begin to wonder, has my life been wasted? Have you ever felt like that, Mr. Cade?
It's just Cade. Look, old timer, I don't have a ton of patience for riddles right now.
Yes, but you want to know, don't you, dude? Why they keep coming here to Earth.
Yes, that was Sir Anthony Hopkins in a Michael Bay Transformers film, Adam. Is it worth trying to summarise the plot of this 2.5-hour behemoth?
I can certainly give it a go.
Can you?
Yeah, I mean, this is the fifth movie in the live-action Transformers series. Michael Bay is back. Mark Wahlberg is back as Cade Yeager, who's a sort of misc bro type, who we find out in this film has a sort of strange connection to the Transformers lore. Interestingly, the film is more about the Arthurian legend.
Or what Michael Bay reckons is Arthurian legend.
Yeah. He actually was apparently thrown off a King Arthur film back in the sort of mid-noughties. So I think this is him exacting his revenge on her for that.
He's exacting his revenge on all sorts of things with this movie, which is, for me, a particularly objectionable watch.
Yeah.
It is the fifth live-action film. 10 years ago, when they first came up with the notion of doing a series of films about a toy that goes from being a car to a robot. If you'd said 5 years later, these will have grossed over $3 billion, and he'll be talking about plans for a prequel and another 14 possible storylines. It's just mental.
Well, he said he's not going to do... Well, Michael Bay and Mark Wahlberg said they're not going to do any more of these films. But I can imagine if this makes more money, which it most likely will, given foreign markets that they're targeting, they'll make loads more. I mean, I don't see why they wouldn't.
Can you find any circumstances in which you would suggest somebody watch this film? Is there any group of person who would actually enjoy this film?
I sort of watched this, quite aware while watching this, that I'm maybe not the target audience. But then I was thinking, OK, if you're a sort of 13-year-old teenage boy, are you going to be interested in the Arthurian lore? Are you going to be interested in Nazis and Stonehenge? And it seems dangerously out of touch and, right, I think a bit lame also.
I mean, there are some interesting storylines there. And I think having been a 13-year-old boy, there was much to enjoy in Arthurian legend and you know, all that business in the Nazis, etc. It's just the fact that he does absolutely nothing with them. It's just another snapshot of a robot smashing something and then we're on to the next thing. It's so long. I did try to approach this with a positive mind to try and at least enjoy the visual spectacle, but it just defeated me utterly.
Especially over the 2.5-hour runtime, it does get very boring, yeah, and you do get quite dulled by the spectacle that goes on, the mayhem around you. But can I say that I quite enjoyed it in miniature?
Really?
It really is cinematic spaghetti thrown at the wall. Like, every half-baked idea they had in the writer's room makes it in here from, as you say, Arthurian legends. It starts in the Dark Ages. We get a World War II flashback to a whole army career that one of the Transformers had that we hadn't heard of in the previous movies. But then, likewise, I found myself enjoying, in snapshot, certain elements. For example, Sir Anthony Hopkins, who is a world-class ham, seeing him in a movie where he gets to say dude in his own way, but also then, on the turn of a dime, bring that natural talent that he has to spout ridiculous dialogue with gravitas.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. But also, little elements in the cast. I love that now that we're, a decade into these big Hollywood movies coming over to the UK for the various tax breaks, we get to see another shot of the Thames, etc. I love that they're getting quite deep into British character actor, TV actor lists here. So one little cameo in here is Rebecca Front from The Thick of It and Armando Iannucci shows as a particularly overbearing aunt for Laura Haddock, who is the romantic interest female co-lead in this. It was such an amazing surprised to see somebody you usually see on the small screen on an IMAX screen,
yeah,
which is kind of like with the previous one, Age of Extinction, seeing Kelsey Grammer from Frasier, etc., in a similarly large movie.
It is remarkable the cast that Michael Bay has managed to attract to this film, but then again, he is a genius and a savant, and not my words, but those of Sir Anthony Hopkins, who spoke of the first four Transformers films, saying they are terrific, they were created by a genius. That's my Anthony Hopkins voice. He said he's the same ilk as Oliver Stone and Spielberg and Scorsese. Brilliant. Savants, really. They are. He's a savant. I know I take this kind of thing too seriously, but watching that film yesterday, seeing Hopkins in that, seeing John Goodman featuring vocally, Steve Buscemi as well, the fact that somebody with as much respect for storytelling and fable as Steven Spielberg was involved in this just makes me think, why do you allow this to happen? You don't need the money. Why do you allow cinema's resources, a man with some artistic talent like Bay, who's made interesting films in the past, to just spunk it up the wall? For me, this film was a little bit like turning up at a very loud house party halfway through where you're sober and everybody else is off their heads and shouting at each other the whole time and then being locked in for another 2.5 hours. My goodness, it was relentless. But as you say, there were bits, the kind of tea room vignette that we had with Rebecca Front, which was the one bit where they actually slowed the editing down.
Yeah, it's amazing how even in dialogue scenes, the first scenes with Mark Wahlberg and so on, the average shot length is still in the, you know, under a second. You're just cutting and cutting and cutting.
How many editors do you normally have in a major blockbuster?
Oh, one or maybe two.
Right, how many editors does this film have?
This one has six.
Six editors.
Yeah, six editors, four writers, one director. Although I think Michael Bay, he loves doing the kind of practical on-set stuff, blowing things up, running around. There's some amazing on-set photography of him with these amazing camera rigs and all that goes with that. But I don't imagine he spends much time in the editing room. I think he probably hands over all the footage and the rushes and says, go on, cobble that together. And it really does feel like it has been quite lazily, I think insultingly so, cobbled together. It's so incoherent.
Prior to going into the cinema, you were talking, Adam, about possibly reclaiming the Michael Bay legacy, of reappraising a maligned director, celebrating some of his finer points. Do you still feel that same way?
I'm a bit of a Bay apologist. I think ultimately people are quite down on him for reasons which I think he may be fully aware of. I think his films are quite tongue-in-cheek often, I respect him for being able to make huge films like this.
That, do you not think that after, I mean, having made four of these, you might go, I'll do something different for my next project?
But he has done different things. He made Pain and Gain a few years ago, which, again, very tongue-in-cheek, very sort of knowing in how ludicrous the whole thing is. Mm. It's a big, fun movie. Like these films, I think, it's just that one has a much clearer idea of what it is and what it's trying to do.
Right, OK. I've not seen episodes 3 and 4 of this series. I gave up after 2 prior to this one. Is this significantly worse than Age of Extinction or Dark of the Moon, or has the series been this bad for a while?
I think it's been quite bad for a while. To be honest, I can't really remember that much about the previous films. I actually realised, going back, that I'd reviewed the last one for us, and I thought I hadn't actually seen it. So I tend to try and blot these films out.
But they do all run together. One thing from Age of Extinction, the first act, actually had this sense of myth-making that this movie strives for with, as we say, Arthurian legends and so on, where Mark Wahlberg is a mechanic who's searching for bits and pieces in a rundown movie theatre. And it's like, what's that over there in the corner? It's a rundown truck, and it was Optimus Prime. There was this sense of kind of legacy and bringing the film back, dusting it off and giving it a new lick of paint. But no, I don't think this is, I mean, apart from the scale of it all, you can see that they're really straining to make this one a large send-off if this is Michael Bay's final film. Throwing everything at the wall, bringing back a few characters. John Turturro comes back. There's a blink and miss Shia LaBeouf photograph cameo. Yeah, so they do bring people back. And also Josh Duhamel, who's from the first three, who wasn't in Age of Extinction. So there is a sense of a franchise there, but talking about Michael Bay, what he can do is scale and spectacle and throwing everything at, you know, the energy of it all. What he can't do is franchise filmmaking, which is what Marvel can do so much better.
Okay, again, don't want to be the negative one, but when you talk about scale and spectacle, this is a big film, but it's so confused that the scale just did nothing for me, because it's impossible to work out what on earth's going on and what it all means when 30 seconds later we're off doing something completely different.
I think this is what's so disappointing about this film in a way, because it's not bad. It's not without any kind of sense of, like you say, legacy of the franchise. It's certainly trying to add to that. It's trying to build on what it's established already. But just on a purely technical point of view, it just feels like they don't care. They have kind of made this film on a huge scale, huge budget, and yet between the 6 editors and the multiple writers and everything else, they've conspired to make this very incoherent, clumsily edited movie. I mean, there's so many shots where a character will like jump down a flight of stairs and in the next shot they're 50 yards away. Just shot by shot, the way it's matched, it's confusing to watch, I think.
No, all right. Well, the Autobots just want to go home, and you will too, watching this movie. That's my tagline, if they want that for the poster.
Nice.
What scores would you give it?
Against my better judgment, I went into this with an open mind, because I do like these, these sort of big, silly movies. And I think it's so close to being passable if it had just been put together and edited better. So I would give it a 3 for anticipation, a 2 for enjoyment, and a 1 in retrospect.
Right. Michael?
1 for anticipation, but then I actually quite enjoyed it, as we said, in Snapshot, so maybe a 3 in enjoyment. Yeah. Just in terms of the pure pleasure of it all, the enjoyment of it all, but then probably it's going to fade into a 1 or a 2, probably, in retrospect.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, my anticipation, you'd kind of talked me into it with this Bay apologism business, but within, didn't take long for me to be flatlining 1s all the way, and it downwards from there, I think, the more I think of it. You'd be better off, here's a suggestion, listeners, is seeking out the 1986 cartoon Transformers the Movie. How about this for a production? A Transformers film featuring Leonard Nimoy, Orson Welles and Weird Al Yankovic.
Yeah, Orson Welles' last film.
Wow. And he was working on it 5 days before he died.
Yeah.
Wow. Great theme tune as well.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. And this is something that Little White Lies have celebrated on the website.
Indeed, yeah. You can go and read a piece about that very film on the website.
All right. Do that, listener.
Yeah.
Do that. Right. Well, after that, next up, let's talk about the mind-meltingly bad Book of Henry.
Did our financial statement come in the mail today?
Yeah, I forgot to give it to you.
I don't know how you do it all by yourself.
Come on, I have Henry. Find me another male of the species who's more grown up than him.
I'd like to.
This story? It's about me, my brother, my mom, and the girl who lived next door.
Henry and Peter, they're lucky to have you.
And your father's lucky to have you too.
Stepfather.
Book of Henry. It sounds quite passable. in that form. But what's the reality of this, Michael Leader?
Oh, gosh, what a completely misjudged horror show this one is. This is the third film from Colin Trevorrow, whose two credits to date include Safety Not Guaranteed, the indie sci-fi drama, and then Jurassic World, massive blockbuster hit from a couple of years ago. This is a smaller film, sort of a, let's say, fairy tale melodrama with a moral, at least that's what's intended, about a young family. It's Naomi Watts as the mum, and the lad from Midnight Special as Henry, and his brother is Jacob Tremblay from Room. And Henry is a child prodigy, a precocious kid who is almost a superhero, really, in the way that he has superhero reasoning, knowledge, and so on. He runs the family. He plays the stock market so that his mum, even though she works a day job at a diner, has vast reserves of money. But he contracts a brain tumour and, quite sadly, halfway through the movie dies, but leaves behind this notebook, the Book of Henry of the title, which leaves instructions for his mum to follow some instructions and leave a mark on the world that Henry intended.
There's a quote from Mike Nichols, which, with The Graduate being re-released, I read this week. It says, a movie is like a person. Either you trust it or you don't. I think one of my issues with this film was that from the very opening exchange where kids are describing their legacy in a classroom, I just absolutely had no feeling of anything real about this movie at all. Nothing seemed genuine.
No, it's tonally a bit of a strange movie. It sets out its stall as a slightly whimsical family melodrama. And by the end, it's this bizarre kiddie revenge thriller. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that clip, it said that it was a story about his mum, his brother and the girl next door, and the instructions left behind is to help this girl next door who may be, you know, the victim of domestic abuse. And it, what's so strange is that she's very rarely in the film. She's given nothing to say. She's purely played as a victim. So it really is just Naomi Watts listening to a tape and reading a notebook and following instructions. It's a very odd one where it becomes something more like kind of Primer, the sci-fi movie, where you know people are just listening to instructions and enacting a plot. It's very strange.
Just bizarre decisions all the way through. The critics, as you've probably seen, have not been kind at all. Boston Globe talking about like a frog being slowly boiled to death. The Atlantic, I like this quote, the exact moment the Book of Henry lost me was when Naomi Watts reached for the ukulele.
And she does some great video game acting in this as well. She's playing a video game.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting cast. You've got Sarah Silverman in there. You mentioned Jacob Tremblay, Jaden Liberer. But almost as if every decision that they took, how can we make this film worse? Just an astonishing series of plot and tonal decisions from the director.
I was just wondering all throughout this film, like, it discusses the idea of every great story having a moral. And I was just baffled as to what they think the moral is in this film. And like you say, every decision made sort of seemingly takes them further away from that. I do think one possible reading is it refutes the theory that video game playing leads to actual violence in the real world.
That's true. Another theory is that it actually was a parody. The screening that I went to, titters started to kind of build as some of the more bizarre plot twists occurred. People started to laugh. Some of the lines as well are just so far out there cheesy that you think they must be joking now. Sadly, I don't think that Colin Trevorrow actually did mean it as a joke. There's some suggestion now that he might not be entrusted the last Star Wars film.
Well, he was entrusted with Star Wars after Jurassic World.
Right.
And, of course, you know, the Jurassic Park franchise and Star Wars kind of share a lot of, you know, similar DNA and lineage and so on. He was anointed by Brad Bird in order to get that role. Brad Bird said, this guy reminds me of me, and suggested him to take on Jurassic World. And, of course, the Jurassic Park franchise, Kathleen Kennedy worked on those films to begin with before she jumped ship to Lucasfilm. So clearly they saw something. And he, even though that film was criticised quite broadly in the press when that came out, Jurassic World did make a lot of money. And he brought home a big hit. So it's clearly a good choice for Star Wars.
That's interesting, though, because Brad Bird's last film didn't make any money. He's a filmmaker who I love, but Tomorrowland absolutely crashed and burned. So God knows why they've let him be the kind of kingmaker there.
Jurassic World did solidly, wasn't particularly loved. Should Star Wars fans be worried?
I don't think so. Well, who knows? We're currently in the almost out of the honeymoon phase with the Star Wars movies. The news that came in overnight as we're recording is that Phil Lord and Chris Miller are off the Han Solo project, which is the first kind of real sign that the Star Wars movies are being handled like the Marvel movies, where the producers have the ultimate power and they're actually much more cowardly than you'd think.
Although we saw something a little bit less overt, but along the same lines with Rogue One.
It was reshot, by Tony Gilroy. So maybe Colin Trevorrow will be taken off the project. Who knows? But I suppose we'll have to see. These films are being made at such a pace.
If he's not, I mean, I had no idea when I was watching it that this guy was lined up to do the third of the new trilogy. But afterwards, I was horrified at the notion.
I would be horrified. This came across like Spielberg light, really. Like he was trying to find a Spielbergian, slightly heightened Americana in this film. When the script, which is quite shockingly written, it's the first original screenplay by I've forgotten his name now. A guy who.
You're doing him a favour by forgetting it.
Exactly. Yeah. Mainly a young adult crime writer. Mm. And there's so many bad sentimental speeches and characterisation. We talk about Sarah Silverman, who's a very funny and quite sensitive actor when she's taken outside of a comedy role. Her first line, she turns up, she's a diner waitress. She's got a massive tattoo on her chest and she says, "Hey, Tuts, what's up?" or something. Like, that's her character in one line and then she doesn't move anywhere from that, doesn't gain dimension. So as much as we can blame the script, I would worry about Colin Trevorrow's future.
One of the difficulties of this film is it's so bad that in trying to analyse why it is such a desperately awful film, you almost build up people's interest. You almost make it intriguing to people. Just the way that the plot veers wildly from one kind of movie to another and then to a third again. But it is a remarkably bad film, and I'm almost tempted to go back and watch it again just to make sure that it actually happened the way I remember.
Oh, definitely. I think there's something quite morbidly fascinating about this film. I actually think they missed a trick slightly with going down this quite cosy, safe route. They could have gone down a much darker route with this. I'd love to have seen a film where Naomi Watts' character, who is essentially emotionally manipulated by her 11-year-old son. I mean, she literally can't make a decision without his authority. Mm. If there was some plot where he was basically getting her to
enact his wishes. Yeah. A Michael Haneke version of this would be incredible, I think. But not this sickly sweet take, no. Yeah. But it's interesting, once a film is anointed, when we saw it, that was after the American reviews had come out, and it's almost been, now this, it's okay to hate this film.
Right.
Go into it, laugh at it, you know, it's a terrible movie.
Yeah.
And I think people do enjoy when they're given free rein to just rag on a movie,
right,
both critics and audiences alike.
Well, if you do enjoy that, then maybe you should go and see Book of Henry, because there's so much to dislike here. We should celebrate that, I suppose. Would you like to give this some numbers?
Oh, gosh, I think this is I had read the reviews beforehand, so in anticipation was way low. It was one.
Right.
But then I think I would give it probably a two for enjoyment, right, just because, as we say, it's at least got good actors in. We don't mention Lee Pace, who's all he turns up as almost like a character who's walked in from the ER set. He's a neurosurgeon with a beard.
Again, tonally so well judged. He arrives to tell the child about his terminal illness and the fact he's got days to live with the words, "Hey, kiddo."
And then, of course, they have an in-depth conversation about neuroscience and brain tumours, because, of course, the kid knows everything there is to know about brain tumours. But, yeah, two for enjoyment and, one in retrospect. Let's not go back.
I didn't really know much about this film before, so I'd give it a three for anticipation and then twos for enjoyment and retrospect.
I came out of this thinking I'm going to use minus numbers for...
You can do.
Yeah. I don't know what they'd be, but this below zero.
Yeah.
The tricky thing is that I was at least comforted by the notion that I'd found the worst film that I'd seen all year, possibly ever. But then I went to see Transformers, and I don't know now which is worse, because at least there was a plot line, at least there was a coherent attempt at storytelling in The Book of Henry, whereas Transformers, my goodness. If we were to discuss the worst film you've ever seen, I would put both these films in my top, or indeed bottom five. Other movies I'd put in there, definitely Zoolander 2, which you used the phrase insultingly bad before. I mean, that would have that epithet branded all over it. Any other absolute stinkers?
It depends how we define worse. Some films are so bad they're good and enjoyably so. I think at least both these films are, well, as we said with Transformers, you can enjoy the spectacle and the flashing lights and the cameos. With Book of Henry, at least it is kind of dulls you into insensibility by how dull it is. But then you can at least engage with it in a sort of what the hell's going on. The worst sorts of films are ones that are ineptly made. So I go back to classics like Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Oh, yeah.
But of course, probably the worst film I've seen in recent years was a film directed by Sean Penn called The Last Face. I don't know if you saw this, Adam.
I missed that.
It was in competition at Cannes last year. And it's Javier Bardem and Charlize Theron as a sort of, as aid workers in crisis zones, and it's just monumentally misjudged. It's supposed to be about the actual causes, but actually it's about these white people having like white people problems.
Right.
And it was just shockingly bad. And seeing it on the Croisette in Cannes almost heightens how bad a film like that is.
It's perverse, isn't it? Because now I actually want to see that film.
I think it finally limped into cinemas a couple of months ago very quietly.
Right.
For a long time, no one bought the rights because it was so badly received.
Wow. Adam?
The one that springs to mind for some reason is Terminator Genesis from a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, that was...
Which is pretty bad. I mean, yeah. so bad that I think they've cancelled the subsequent sequel that they were intending there.
Mm. Can we throw Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice in here? Because that was an absolute stinker as well.
But again, that's got some like redeeming qualities to it, I think. And also, it's a movie which, you know, it's not particularly well made, I'll give you that. But again, it's one of these huge spectacle movies that I think it does deliver a certain level of pleasure. And it's quite strange, some of the decisions that are made. But I wouldn't say it's like one of the worst movies ever.
I do think Zack Snyder is the sort of filmmaker who is a terrible filmmaker, but every now and then stumbles onto a fantastic shot. So I at least applaud his vision compared to some Marvel movies, which may be generally better made,
right,
but often look like they're shot in a car park. So at least with Batman and Superman.
Right.
Well, if you think about the action sequences in the last five Marvel movies, they all take place in either airfields or car parks or you know some anonymous open area.
Yeah.
I feel that Zack Snyder's Batman at least has a sort of a very stylized and saturated vision behind them, even if they're quite tonally misjudged, if they're bloated and so on.
A lot of the action sequences in Fight Club took place in car parks, but nobody had a problem with that, Michael.
Or did they?
Yeah, maybe. Right. There you go then. That was Book of Henry and Worst Films Ever. We should probably mention it at this point, the world of acting and drama in general, culture, just the world in general, has been rocked to its core by the news that Daniel Day-Lewis is hanging up his acting boots.
Gloves. Are you a fan?
Well, of course.
Who isn't, right?
Yeah, who isn't? But he hasn't made a film since 2012.
Lincoln, I think.
5 years now. And he has got a film coming out later this year, December, now, a new Paul Thomas Anderson, who famously helmed There Will Be Blood, which I think a lot of people would regard as his greatest, yeah? It's going to be called The Phantom Thread, or Phantom Thread. So there's that. But Day-Lewis has let it be known that he's not going to do any more acting after that. Thanks. Adam, you don't seem particularly distressed at this. You're not red-eyed or...
I think he's a very good actor. But, you know, I would only pick out maybe a handful of roles that he's done that I really genuinely love. I think There Will Be Blood is definitely one of them. Mm. The Age of Innocence, Martin Scorsese, is another one. And actually, I quite like Gangs of New York.
Do you?
Yeah. I think first time round, I was quite disappointed by it. But his Bill the Butcher is quite pantomimey, and yeah, there's a lot to like in that character, I think.
Right. A lot of pieces today celebrating his method approach, how he learnt Czech to play the Doctor in Unbearable Lightness and Being and confined himself to a wheelchair for My Left Foot. But for Gangs of New York, listen to Eminem. So he has, of course, once disappeared from the acting world before. So some people are suggesting it's going to be a similar thing. He'll be back.
Well, it's so hard to miss somebody who only makes... He's only made five films in the last decade or something like that. So it's not like he's a constant presence on our screens that we'd miss. And also, I think maybe in 10, 15 years, once he starts getting into, say, let's say, King Lear territory, maybe he will come back, just retire.
For Transformers 20, something like that.
If the paycheck's big enough. But I'd say my recommendation, if people are kind of looking back at his career, is go all the way back to My Beautiful Laundrette, which was the star-making role in the mid-80s. It was originally a TV movie, one of the first Film 4 productions, in fact, not to sound like I'm towing the party line too much, but it's such an underrated film. It's not really talked about enough, and he plays Johnny, who's a very confused young man in London who is torn between the sort of skinhead friends he has, but then also this burgeoning romance he has with this Pakistani laundrette owner. And it's such a beautiful interracial love story, beautiful gay love story that still is very relevant. And it's been sort of neglected for years, but it's getting the sort of lavish BFI Blu-ray treatment in August, so worth checking out.
Oh, nice one.
We should do that for a film club.
We should do that for a film club. Speaking of film clubs, that's up next. We're going to be all about The Benjamin as we discuss The Graduate.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Listener, if you're new to Truth and Movies, this is the bit where we watch or have watched a classic film, one you may have missed or that just generally warrants reappraising. And this week it's The Graduate, which has actually got a re-release this Friday in the UK in cinemas in celebration of its 50th anniversary. And from the poster which they've done, which is very nice, I mean, they've got a cougar. Next to the young Dustin Hoffman. They seem to be marketing it as a comedy, which is an interesting choice. I mean, it certainly is a funny film. What struck me was the fact that it was so fresh. One or two kind of flash frames and wobbly pans aside, it still feels a really fresh film 50 years on.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's got some universal themes in a way, which I think the freshness comes from the fact that it's just beautifully directed, written, acted. I mean, there really isn't, I think, anything out of place in this film. And I also just love the way it's paced. I mean, it couldn't be more opposite to something like Transformers in the way it's... I mean, totally different films, obviously. But, yeah, it's just so slow and meditative and melancholy. The humour, I get a little bit of that. But, yeah, it's a profoundly sad film, I think.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly fresh for me because I hadn't seen this before.
Really?
So that was always one of the films that I kept in my back pocket. I've seen many other Dustin Hoffman films, many other Mike Nichols films, but I thought I'd come to it on a rainy day. Instead, I watched it on a sunny day over the weekend. And yes, what struck me was, even though it's held up as one of these kind of high watermark moments in early New Hollywood, it's such an art movie and clearly influenced by European filmmakers. Clearly, it's one of those movies where there are a few key iconic scenes that we've seen parodied, but there's so much more to it. And you talk about the flash frames and so on, but there's a sort of playfulness with form there that I wasn't expecting. And I presumed that it would be more of a comedy, knowing, you know, Mike Nichols comes from the Nichols and May, you know, comedy duo beforehand, and you know, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is very much a stagey production, very much character, you know, performance led. And it was such a hazy movie, The Graduate, and melancholy, as Adam said. And Dustin Hoffman plays such a nervy, neurotic character, contrasted with Anne Bancroft, who is fantastic in this role. So cat-like, but then so sad when required. Although I do find it quite fascinating, the age difference between the two is only 7 or 6 years. She was in her mid-30s, and he had just turned 30. There's a cameo from Richard Dreyfuss later in the movie as one of the dorm room students when he goes up to Berkeley. He's like in the background. I think he has one line where he says, "Should I call the cops?" And Dreyfuss is actually 20 in that movie, so probably closer to Benjamin Braddock's age. And that's probably one thing I would say about the movie. Hoffman definitely does not look 21.
No, I think he carries himself, even though he's meant to be this quite sad figure. He does a lot of soul searching. He's very anxious. He also carries himself with a certain authority. He seems very comfortable in his own skin as an actor and, you know, as the character. But I first watched this film actually when I was a student, and oddly, it resonates more with me, I think, today. Possibly just because my cinema going experiences have become much broader since then, and certainly a lot of the European art house influences you mentioned. But yeah, as I say, it's a profoundly sad movie. I think possibly one of the all-time great movie endings,
yeah,
which is a real, you know, heartbreaker, I think.
Yeah.
We all know it from Wayne's World, I suppose, where he runs into the church and is banging on the glass, you know, Elaine, Elaine, or we know it from the Vic and Bob adverts in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
But the final shot is one of those great shots, and there are only a few. We were trying to think of some the other day where they're both on the bus driving away, off to have their romance, even though when you see the full film, you realise that romance is just as much born out of boredom and desperation. There's no actual connection between those characters. So you see this sort of excitement on their faces slightly drain away into, well, what do we do now?
Yeah, what's next? I actually wondered watching this whether there's any kind of parallel to Ghost World, which we did on Film Club a few weeks ago with the ending and the metaphor of the bus riding off and what it means, you know, what is life.
Very interesting point.
It's such a poetic movie. One of the things, the recurring motif of the swimming pool, which is used in so many different ways. You know, he's drifting. When he says, what are you doing, Benjamin? He's like, I'm drifting. But then also where he's dressed up in the scuba diving outfit and forcibly pushed underwater by his parents. That's such a potent image for the pressure put upon this character.
Yeah.
But then also a space of calm and isolation when he dunks himself under there to avoid the family party.
It's interesting. You mentioned Anne Bancroft and her performance, and the film is not in any way told from her perspective, although she does reveal the fact that there is a human side to the vastly decadent society that Benjamin has returned to college from. She does allow a few glimpses into the fact that they're essentially just people as almost as lost as Benjamin himself is. But I did think, crikey, if you're Sofia Coppola, this is the film you should remake from a feminist perspective rather than, say, The Beguiled.
Well, make it from the Catherine Ross perspective, I think would also be fascinating. Yeah. There needs to be a companion.
Because she's completely empty in this film.
One of my favourite scenes, I think, is when Benjamin and Mrs. Robinson are in bed together after their fling has been going on for some time, and he wants to have more of a kind of connection with her and gets her talking a bit about her own backstory in her own life, which we haven't had really anything of up to this point. And she basically reveals that the reason she's in this loveless marriage is that she got pregnant. And that makes you realise how life spins on these moments that are sometimes out of your control. And she is this quite tragic figure in the film, I think.
Yeah, very much so. Wow. All right, so that was The Graduate. I hope you enjoyed it, listeners. What are we going to talk about next week? Callum Willard, I think that is, says, can you consider Casino for Film Club? I think it's almost forgotten about in the shadow of Goodfellas. Terrific film, isn't it, Casino?
I like Casino very much. Mm. But I think for next week, the main film we're going to be talking about is Baby Driver by Edgar Wright.
Right.
And one of the key influences on that film was a Jean-Pierre Melville film called Le Samurai.
Ooh.
Which I think is getting a re-release at some point later this year. It'd be a very interesting one to rewatch.
1967.
Yeah.
Featuring Alain Delon.
Yeah, the great Alain Delon, and one of his best roles, I think.
It's a fabulous film to brag about having watched, so get out there and get on that. He plays a professional hitman called Jeff Costello. Fantastic. And it's French. Brilliant. All right, well, I'm looking forward to that. I've not seen it before. Have you seen that one, Michael?
I've not seen it before. I've only seen one Melville film, Army of Shadows, which is incredible, but I'd love to catch up with this one.
Right, super. Anything else that we should mention before we wrap this one up?
I was just going to mention that I'm off to Edinburgh tomorrow for the film festival, the 71st Edinburgh Film Festival.
Wow, okay. What are you most looking forward to seeing up there?
Well, there's a few highlights in the programme. The new Terrence Malick film, Song to Song, is playing there. But yeah, I had a quick squiz through the programme, and it's a absolutely bumper programme this year, but there's some really interesting looking British made films. There's a Morrissey biopic, which I don't know, people seem to be quite anti Morrissey, which is fair enough. But
is it a dramatisation?
A dramatisation of his life, yeah.
Does Daniel Day-Lewis play Stephen Patrick
Morrissey? He should do.
He should do, shouldn't he? Yeah.
It looks like it's going to be a good year for Discovery, so I'm going in with an open mind.
Okay, good. All right. Excellent. What are you going to be up to, Michael?
In the next fortnight, Misc Films has the next screening. We're showing Taika Waititi's Boy, which was a film that he made before What We Do in the Shadows and Hunt for the Wilder People, which wasn't released over here. It's a great coming-of-age story set in an 80s Maori community.
Okay.
We're showing that at the Prince Charles on the 6th of July. We're getting ready for that.
Okay, super. Excellent. Well, many thanks for that. And thanks for being with us today to yourself and Adam and you, listener, for giving us a little bit of your busy schedule. We've got another one coming up next week in which we will, as you say, Adam, be discussing Baby Driver. Really looking forward to seeing that. We'll also be touching on Bong Joon-ho's Okja, which is going to be simultaneously dropping, is that right, on Netflix and cinemas? And who knows what else we'll be talking about too. In the meantime, many thanks for being with us today. This has been a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.